From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
People are living under the illusion that the American dream is working for them, and it's rigged by the guys at the tippy top.
That's Laura Dern in a scene from the HBO series Enlightened, which concluded its second season last night. This season, Laura Dern's character blew the whistle on the corporation that demoted her. Neither she nor we were ever sure how much of her idealism was motivated by just wanting to lead a more interesting life. Today we talk with Enlightened's co-creator, writer, and co-star Mike White about developing a complex main character who, ever since rehab, tried and often failed to become her higher self, and then tried to take on corporate greed. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews two classic Cinerama films, now out on DVD and Blu-ray. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The HBO series Enlightened ended its second season last night. I hope it gets renewed because I think it's one of the best shows on TV. My guest, Mike White, co-created the series with Laura Dern. He also wrote all the episodes, directed a few, and is one of the show's stars. When we recorded our interview over a week ago before my vacation, he was on his way to an HBO lunch where he expected to find out the show's fate, but he didn't. Enlightened walks the line between comedy and drama. Season one began with Amy Jellicoe, played by Laura Dern, returning home after a stay in rehab, where she learned to meditate and get in touch with what she describes as her higher self. But when she returns to work, staying means accepting a demotion. Separated from her husband and living in her mother's suburban home, her life feels empty. Throughout season one, it was difficult to stay in touch with her higher self, but she still believed she could change. In season two, after being less than successful in changing herself, she wants to make an impact on the world and live a bigger life. She decides to become a whistleblower at the corporation where she works and tries to convince her shy, inhibited office mate, Tyler, played by Mike White, to use his IT expertise to help. Here's a scene from early in season two where she's telling him that she's used his password to hack into corporate email accounts looking for incriminating evidence to bring down the corporation.
Okay, so I started in Damon's accounts, right? And then I just like went into every email I could open, all the top execs, and like, we knew they were plunderers, just screwing their workers, covering up their dirty dumping. That's not the sickest part. They don't care, Tyler. They don't care. They're hurting people and they know it, and it's a game to them. They make jokes about it in these emails. When this comes out, we're talking about at least 100 class action lawsuits.
What do you mean when it all comes out? How's it gonna come out?
There's this guy, Jeff Blender. He's at the LA Times. He writes these corporate exposés. He is the perfect journalist for this.
Oh my God, please just don't go back in there with my password. They will trace it back to me.
Tyler, I have to go back in. I don't have a hard copy. I couldn't get the printer to work. You know, it always jams up. I need your help.
No. I gave you that password in a moment of weakness. I'm not getting any deeper into this.
Don't you feel an obligation? People are living under the illusion that the American dream is working for them. And it's rigged by the guys at the tippy top.
Well, I may not be at the top, but I'm happy.
No, you're not. You're miserable. You're a mole. You're paralyzed.
Well, I'm changing. I just joined the company gym, and I got a discount because of my employee badge, and I'm going to work out more. And my aunt died, and I just found out I got her timeshare, so I'm going to go to the Bahamas for 2 weeks a year. So maybe I'm a mole, but I'm a happy mole, and I don't want to lose what little I have, okay?
You've already lost it. They're shutting us down.
And what they're shutting down is the department that the Laura Dern character and the Mike White character work in. Mike White, welcome back to Fresh Air. It is so great to have you again. I really loved this season.
Oh, awesome.
So as we record now, you're about to find out the fate of the show. You're about to have lunch with HBO to find out whether you're renewed or not. So if you don't mind my asking, it sounds like in preparation for this lunch, you've done a lot of thinking about what you hope the show means in the lives of viewers like me. So what do you hope the show means? What would you say to fight for the life of your program?
Well, it's complicated because, you know, there's a world of the bottom line and like ratings and numbers. And fortunately, HBO is a place that the criteria for success is a little bit more nebulous. It's not so simple as that. At the same time, that is still meaningful. And in the last couple of weeks, just from, I don't know, like anecdotally or emails or going online or tweets or whatever it is, you know, the response to the show, it does feel like it's picking up as far as like, you know, people being aware of the show, but also people feeling like they're having a deep reaction to the show. And for me, you know, the reaction, just like just what people are saying is, you know, all I ever really want, you know, as far as a creator, to feel like people are having a deep and a positive and meaningful reaction to what I'm making.
So this season was different from the first. The first was focused on Laura Dern's character coming back home and back to work after a stay in rehab where she learned how to meditate, and she really tried to be her better self. But it's hard to be her better self when she's back in the world again. The new season, she's working to change the world through bringing down her corporation. How did you decide to take it in that direction?
Well, the truth was that the original pitch to HBO was that it would get to that whistleblower place in the first season. But as I started writing it, I realized there was like kind of nooks and crannies of her life that I wanted to explore. And I don't know, I got more interested in the digressions than the overall like meta plot. And so as I got into it, I was like, we're not going to be able to get to this here. And so it became a two-seasoner instead of one season. But I did also find that as I was, you know, as the show went out into the world, some of the things that I think are interesting and I felt like would, you know, bring people back week to week, that she was a polarizing character, and that so some people just kind of retreated from her. And I felt like at the same time, you know, you had a show like Homeland where the character is, you know, equally like manic and, I don't know, off a rocker in a sense. And that, you know, it became such a consensus kind of show. And it was because I think it was, you know, very plotty. And while our show obviously would never be Homeland, and nor did I want it to be, but I felt like, you know, it might help the second season too to build it out a little bit and to give some of that kind of sense of, you know, a cliffhanger kind of moments in our own enlightened way, which is really more about character than it is about plot, hopefully.
So I'm going to ask you to describe your character, Tyler. And one of the episodes in this season of Enlightened was told from the perspective of your character. So describe Tyler and how you envisioned him changing in season two.
I felt like Amy needed to have like her Ethel at the office, or like Ethel to her Lucy. And it felt like, you know, Amy has these kind of, in a way she's feminine, but she also has this kind of, she has some traditionally masculine aspects. She wants to be a part of the public. So she's very, you know, extroverted. She's very kind of, in her own way, aggressive. And I just thought it'd be interesting from, like, you know, a gender place to, like, have her helpmate be, like, a guy. But he's, like, the supporter, more passive, the one who's just kind of helping her and is more kind of the introvert. And so it was basically his, like, unreciprocated crush on her that kind of drove him to continue helping her. And then in the second season, I thought it would be interesting, you know, since he's the one that's been helping her, that then it becomes, he's become at cross purposes because he, in the process of helping Amy, you know, fight the man, he ends up finding someone who could actually be his, you know, soulmate or someone who would love him back, and that those things would end up being in jeopardy, or, you know, only one can win.
And, you know, Amy thinks that in order to get access to corporate emails that can help blow the whistle on what the corporation's doing wrong and help bring, you know, charges against the CEO, she asked your character, Tyler, who, you know, knows a lot about IT, to basically break into the hard drive of the CEO's assistant, who's played by Molly Shannon. And in order to do that, she wants you to kind of, you know, maybe go out on a date with her and pretend like you're really interested in her. But the thing is, you get really interested in her, and you do go out on a date with her, and she gets interested in you. And just as you're finally having like a woman in your life and you're finally truly connecting to somebody, you're also feeling so guilty about it because you know that even though it's not your agenda, you're being deployed as part of an agenda and that she's going to get hurt. So I'd like to play a clip from the scene in which you are together at your home for the first time, you and the Molly Shannon character. And you're both very shy. She's very worried about getting hurt because she's been hurt before. And so you're sitting on the living room couch and, you know, starting to get to know each other a little bit. It's a little bit awkward. And you're exchanging your first kiss. Mm.
Do you want to spend the night?
You know, you don't really look me in the eye that much.
Sorry.
Look, I just don't want to get hurt, okay? I'm just at the age where I don't want to go through all that, you know? I don't have expectations. I don't care, whatever. But I just don't want to deal with a jerk or someone who's fake or mean, you know? You seem sad and sweet, and I like that. But are you sweet?
I think so.
I'm just too old to get kicked in the face, you know?
Well, it's not my plan.
That's not your plan.
I love that scene because, like, you're not, your character isn't fake and mean, but he's now in the position of inadvertently being fake. And she's so vulnerable in the scene. She's so good, Molly Shannon. You know,
I can't believe you played The Sounds of Us Kissing.
I did that for a reason.
Like, it's killing me.
I did that for a reason.
Smacking of the lips.
No, you know, I'm always interested. It seems to me now, I did that for a reason. It seems to me now that in the movies, kisses are mic'd more closely than they've ever been before. And you actually hear the sound of the kissing. And there's like different kinds of sounds for the different kisses. And in this case, it was like short staccato chirp kisses. Like... And I was wondering, like, so when you wrote that scene, did you describe how the kisses would sound? Did you, when you talked to Molly Shannon about that scene, did you agree on, like, what the percussive qualities of the kiss would be? The tonal and percussive qualities.
It was built to be awkward in so many ways. I mean, the characters would clearly be awkward. But, you know, Molly and I are really good friends and have been friends for a long time. And I don't know, the idea of, like, suddenly kissing her. I just felt, you know, obviously Tyler's not, you know, a sexual dynamo. He has probably had very limited sexual experience, and sounds like she has too. So, you know, that kind of like junior high kiss seemed like the way to go with that.
Yeah, it said to me too, like, they were afraid to have a sustained kiss. Like, short kisses were safer, and we could see, like, oh, do we want to do a second kiss?
Right.
A third?
Right.
Okay, settling
right.
In. Fourth kiss.
Anyway, yes, Terry, what's your question?
Well, that kind of was the question. And choreographing it too, like making sure that it looked authentic but really uncomfortable.
Right.
And uncertain.
Well, I think we were just kind of, I don't know, we were just in character and did it. There wasn't really a lot of discussion beforehand about how it would go, but it seemed right, at least to the director, you know, at the time. It felt like that was the right approach.
My guest is Mike White, the co-creator, writer, and co-star of the HBO series Enlightened, which ended its second season last night. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. You're just joining us. My guest is Mike White. He's the creator of the HBO series Enlightened, and he wrote all the episodes and directed many of them and is also the co-star. So in the second season, the character of Amy, played by Laura Dern, decides to try to take down the corporation that she works for because she knows that they're a polluter. She suspects they're guilty of other things too, and she wants to be an agent of change and change the world through changing this company. And also, she just wants a different life. She's tired of being a nobody. She's tired of being bored and of leading a boring life. Since you had to write from the perspective of somebody who wants to be a whistleblower, what did you do in preparation for that? Did you talk to anybody who'd been it, or, you know, read one of those many whistleblower memoirs that have been published?
Well, I have. I mean, over the years, you know, that's something that's interesting to me. But I didn't really do a lot of, like, in-depth research. I mean, Amy is kind of flying blind, so it's not like it's,
exactly,
it's a little
yeah.
bit like the layman's, like, entry into what that is. So, like, I tried to get some of the sort of, like, more plotty machinations right. Like, how would that actually work? But as far as, you know, the thing that I like about Amy as a character and why I feel like she's worthy of a show is that she is, and I think that this is something that you could apply to some whistleblowers, you know, not all. There is a righteous cause, but there is also, you know, somebody who potentially has like a Joan of Arc complex or, you know, somebody who has a little bit of delusions of grandeur. You know, it's like somebody wrote online, like, why doesn't Amy just volunteer at a local charity if she wants to feel good? And it was a funny question because I was like, that would never be enough for her. Like, you know, she wants big change because she wants to be a big character and a big drama. And it's what makes her a flawed character, but it also maybe amusing, but also it's part and parcel with why she wants to be a whistleblower, because she wants to, like, burn it down.
And she's so naive, though. She doesn't even know much about the issues that she wants to bring to the forefront. She's just naive in every way. And through the journalist who she's leaking these corporate emails to, she, you know, gets exposed to Twitter, and she sees, like, he's got a lot of followers, and she goes to, like, a book party, and the author has a lot of followers on Twitter, so she decides she needs to be on Twitter, and she goes around telling people, like, you have to follow me on Twitter, because, you know, I think she's up to, like, 14 followers by the end of the episode after having tapped, like, everybody that she knows. And she doesn't even know the language for him, and she wants to twit. But the ending of the episode is so wonderful because it's a voiceover and she's thinking about how now she's really part of that, you know, revolution where we're all interconnected through social media and being online. And so what I want to do is play that voiceover that ends the episode. And then I'm going to ask you to tell us what we've actually been watching as we've listened to the voiceover. So here's the voiceover. Okay. This is Laura Dern.
I have joined the new world. I learn its language. Clicking and flashing and pinging. I read its signs. Electric. Invisible. In this world, the meek like me will finally rise. And the confused will become certain. And the powerful will be laid low. And we will all unite in a single current of compassion and action. The new world. It is so close. You can hear its angels buzzing. It is here. Follow me. Follow me.
That's Laura Dern in a voiceover from Enlightened, the series created by my guest Mike White, who also wrote all the episodes and co-stars in it. So as we hear her say that everyone will unite in a single current of compassion and action through the internet. Mike White, what are we actually seeing happening on screen?
Well, you're starting with seeing a bunch of different characters that we know either on their phones or online. And then by the end, you're at the Starbucks where everybody is, you know, all at their computers and at their smartphones. And they're, you know, most of them are just, you know, scrolling through pictures of somebody's vacation or, you know, on some gossip site, and they all slightly have their mouths agape or, you know, half zoning off. And, you know, to me, it's like, you know, yeah, it gets into my whole anxiety about technology and social media and all of that.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a scene, like the scene in the Starbucks, everybody, the cafe is filled But no one is talking to each other. Everybody's just on their personal device looking at a screen. So,
right.
But the Laura Dern character feels so, she feels this so deeply, even though it's kind of delusional. And it's not all delusional because there's so much that the internet and social media have done. But to hear her feel something so deeply and to at the same time see how kind of delusional it is so interesting.
Well, to me, it's, I mean, I like that you played that clip because when I saw it, when we finally executed it, I was like, well, this is, I mean, this is, this kind of encapsulates all of the weird tone of the show and why the show is both, like, I guess, challenging for an audience and certainly challenging to know how to sell it. But it's also what I am proud of in a sense, because it's funny because I have a friend who's like a big social, like Twitter, and he brought me on his podcast show and he had read that completely straight. And it was like, this is what I've been trying to tell everybody. Like, this is, and he never saw that, like, the sort of like a sardonic aspect of it as, and that then others see it completely as this, as a critique of, you know, technology or that. And the fact that it could be open enough to contain both readings mm-hmm. is a pleasure, as at least as a writer for me. And I feel like that's Amy, that Amy is somebody who has these great, you know, her intentions are great, and it is very, the idealism is beautiful to me. At the same time, like in reality, how that actually works itself out is always a little bit more, a little less than or something.
Mike White will be back in the second half of the show. He's the co-creator, writer, and co-star of the HBO series Enlightened, which ended its second season last night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Family Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from RDO, a digital music service allowing listeners to discover millions of songs and listen everywhere, RDIO.com. From the Langloth Foundation, supporting innovative health and mental health programs for underserved populations at langloth.org. And from Angie's List, providing reviews of local contractors, dentists, electricians, and mechanics to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Mike White tells us about how the whistleblowing plot in Enlightened connects to his father, Mel White, who was a ghostwriter for a number of televangelists, but after coming out as gay, he spoke out against religious extremism. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews two early Cinerama films, now on DVD. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mike White, the co-creator, writer, and co-star of the HBO series Enlightened, which ended its second season last night. The series stars co-creator Laura Dern as Amy Jellicoe, who learned how to meditate in rehab, but after returning to her life, has trouble keeping her equilibrium. In season two, in her attempt to become an agent of change and make her mark on the world, she tries to take down the corporation where she works. You know, in talking about your character, Amy, played by Laura Dern, of turning her into a whistleblower, I'm thinking a little bit about your father, who I don't know that I would describe him as a whistleblower, but in some ways he was a whistleblower. Your father, Mel White, had been the ghostwriter for some of the really big born-again televangelist preachers, including it was Jim Baker, right? And Jerry Falwell and
Pat Robertson. Billy Graham.
And then your father came out as being gay and eventually started really talking about some of the homophobic things that had happened behind the scenes in that world. And then he started like showing up at Jerry Falwell's church to protest the homophobia that he was creating and fostering. So what did you see of, you know, the gifts and the consequences for your father of having been a kind of whistleblower?
Well, I think that Amy reminds me of my father in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, I've said this in certain interviews, and I think, you know, I hope he doesn't take it the wrong way. But, you know, I think that, you know, when he came out, he wanted to, in a sense, make restitution for having participated in the world of the kind of right-wing religious extremism and feeling like, you know, that was really at odds with his own soul, and that he wanted to, yeah, become an activist in a sense of trying to explain how this kind of hate speech that he feels like is, you know, coming out of this religious world has real implications and creates suffering amongst people. And he wanted to tell these, like, you know, in a sense, father figures to him how much they are hurting him and the other sort of gay children in the religious world. And at the same time, I think it was also important, like Amy, to not just do good, but to be seen as being good. Because that part of it was like his own, you know, I don't know, it was his own struggle to feel like he's worthy and worthwhile. And also he wanted the world to see, you know, gays can be good people and that they're not, I don't know, whatever the image was. So with Amy, I see her as somebody who wants to be good and also wants to be seen as good. And maybe that's a redemption story for herself. And so I see that in him.
But what about the consequences that your father was maybe not prepared for? Just as like Amy isn't prepared for certain consequences.
It's funny because we went on The Amazing Race together. And when you do The Amazing Race, you sit down and you take this like all the psych tests under the sun you have to take. And then afterwards you sit with a psychologist with the team and they kind of go over your results. And it's like, it's funny because, you know, you see the people on these reality shows and some of them are just can be so off the beam. But like my dad actually failed the test. Like we weren't like going to be able to go because his answers to the test. And they were like, you come off on these tests as completely paranoid. You respond in the same way that young African-American men in certain, you know, dangerous cities respond. Like in a place like you think people are trying to kill you. And he was like, they are. And he's like, I get hate mail every day. And the thing that I don't think my dad realizes is that by trying to, like, in a sense, bang his head against this certain kind of wall, you know, he would go into like these religious schools where he would be spit on, you know, and people would put up posters with the most, you know, hateful speech on it. And he would go in like week after week and face that kind of hate. And I think that I don't think he realized how much that hate would, you know, like impact him. And that part is, it makes me proud of him, but I also feel for him.
We've talked about your father before on the show, and your father's been on our show several times. I'm thinking about your mother now because you have written such an interesting and complex mother character in the character of Amy, Laura Dern's mother on Enlightened. And she's played by Laura Dern's actual mother, Diane Ladd. And last season, there was just a beautiful episode where Diane Ladd is at the supermarket and she runs into one of her old friends who she hasn't seen in a long time. And everything seems to be going so well for like this old friend's like children and grandchildren, whereas in Diane Ladd's life, she's kind of shut herself down because she's been hurt so much, and she's seen her children hurt, and she's been hurt by her children. And it's just a really sad and beautiful episode in which we develop some empathy for a character who had previously just been so standoffish and cold. And this season, there's a very interesting scene between Diane Ladd and Laura Dern toward the end of the season, in which Laura Dern figures it's like time to tell her mother, since they live together, that things are about to change because she's blown the whistle on the corporation she works for. It's going to be in the LA Times, and things are going to be different. And so this is the scene where she breaks it to her mother.
Mom, we need to talk. Things are coming to a head. I feel like you need to know.
Oh, no.
Oh, no, no. It's not bad. It's not bad. I've blown the whistle on Abaddon. I found this really damaging information about the CEO. And, I leaked it to the LA Times. And they're running a huge story. And I'm in it.
Why would you do that?
Because the guy's a criminal, and the company's really crooked, and they hurt a lot of people, you know?
And why is that your business?
Mom, it's everybody's business.
No, it's not, Amy. They brought you back after all that you did. And this is how you repay them? You know, Amy, you have done a lot of foolish things in your life, but this is too much. What's next? You gonna blow the whistle on me?
Forget it. You know what? The LA Times thinks what I did is brave.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
Are they going to pay you? Are they going to get you a job? Are they going to get you out of debt? Are they gonna put a roof over your head?
Mom, there are things that are bigger than me.
Yes, there are things bigger than you. And I cannot stand by and watch you destroy your own life.
Then don't. I'll move out.
I think you should.
Oh, nice scene. Very, very kind of sad. Laura Dern and her real-life mother, Diane Ladd, playing daughter and mother in a scene from Enlightened, which was created, totally written by my guest, Mike White, who's also a co-star of the series. It's another example where they're kind of both right. Like, Laura Dern's right about how sometimes there's things bigger than yourself, and her mother's right, like, you're in debt. Like, maybe this isn't the greatest time to be a whistleblower. And you really feel for them because they just have such a hard time connecting, even though you're sure they have deep feelings for each other. But it made me wonder about your mother and how she took it, like, when she learned that your father is gay, and then also when he came out publicly and had all this, like, hatred directed against him, like you were just describing. How did she handle that?
Well, I'm really glad you asked the question, because I do think that some people, you know, have wondered if, like, there's parallels here. I mean, the truth is, my mother is an activist herself, like, she's a pillar of her community as far as, like, working with, you know, disenfranchised people. And she does not take the position of Diane Ladd's character in the show, and has really been actually my dad's biggest supporter. You know, it, similar to me, you know, hates to see him get hurt by his activism, but, you know, is a supporter. She's, you know, my mom is like, I have a very non-tortured relationship with my mom. People sometimes seem surprised, because often, you know, there's a lot of tortured characters in the stuff I write. But she's been, you know, my mom is like the happiest person, the most like functional person in our family. She's the rock in my world.
So Amy so much, you know, the Laura Dern character so much wants to kind of connect to a larger world, a bigger world, a world with, like, issues and activism. And part of the reason why she's a whistleblower is as a way of entering through the door to a more interesting world. And I'm wondering what it was like for you when you tried to start establishing yourself as a writer and to get into that world, to get into the world of movies and TV shows, and to have, you know, a voice as a writer.
Well, I think, I mean, that's interesting. I relate to Amy in that way. I remember I grew up in Pasadena in a very kind of homogenous, kind of suburban existence. And then I went to college at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. And there were all these kind of hipster New York kids who were so cultured and had so much, you know, like knew all the references and like already had their look down. And I have always felt like, I don't know, I missed the first day of French class and like I started the second day and I was like, what did they teach on the first day? Because it felt like, I was like, and that's how I always had felt about this certain kind of, these people who all, you know, I don't know, I felt like I was always fighting to find like-minded people or, you know, I had to go to the library and, you know, look up, you know, like, I don't know, it was kind of like I had to self-teach myself certain things and learn about culture in a way because it wasn't so accessible in a sense.
So when you were teaching yourself about culture, what were some of the books or TV shows or movies that made you feel like you weren't alone and that, yeah, you know, that you could connect to things that were bigger?
Yeah. My second grade teacher was Sam Shepard's mother.
You're kidding.
No. And like, I really loved her and she was like this cool teacher. And it was the first time I'd heard of like she was proud of her son.
He's a playwright, for people who don't know him. He's a playwright who's also done some acting.
Yeah, and he had written that play, Buried Child, and I was maybe 8 years old or something, and I wanted to get that. I wanted her to love me. So, like, I had Buried Child, and I, like, of course I didn't understand it, really, but I remember walking around with it and, like, looking at the way the words laid out on the page. And I think that was when I first started writing little dialogue between characters And then, like, I got into Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I remember seeing, I was at a record store and I saw, like a recorded version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And I honestly couldn't have been more than 10 years old. And I insisted that my parents buy it and I recorded it on a tape. And then on, like, long drives, I would follow along in the script and then, like, listen to the actors say the words and I would, like, perform it with matchbox cars and stuff. Yeah. And so, I don't know, like, even when I was little, I would write these, like, plays about, you know, people having cocktail parties and talking about adulterous affairs and stuff I had no, like, yeah, way more pretentious than anything I write now.
My guest is Mike White, the co-creator, writer, and co-star of the HBO series Enlightened, which ended its second season last night. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to my interview with Mike White, the co-creator, writer, and co-star of the HBO series Enlightened, which ended its second season last night. Laura Dern, who co-created the series, stars as Amy Jellicoe. The last time you were on the show, during season one of Enlightened, we talked about how Amy's experiences in rehab and then her difficult re-entry into the world of her home and her neighborhood and her office, you know, the difficulty of that was based in part on your experience after having this really big anxiety attack because of something that happened at work on the TV series that you were working on. And so, as I recall, you were basically taken to like a mental hospital where you thought like, I don't really belong here. It's like work-related anxiety. I'm not like schizophrenic or mentally ill or anything. But that's when you started reading Buddhism, or at least when you started reading it like very seriously. And I'm wondering, are you still reading that? Are you still trying to hold on to something of that calm place that you know exists that's so hard to find when you're stressed out and working on deadline?
Yeah, I mean, I do. And honestly, I feel like that experience and reading those things have changed me. And I feel like there's something about what those books did for me that I guess was what I'm trying to do on Enlightened in a sense, which is trying to It's like the hope is, you know, it's like at some point you're like, okay, my mind's been blown. It's like, how do I stitch it back together? You know, it's like, how do I create something that is, it's a cliche, it's a new age cliche, but like, be the change you want to see. It's like, how do I create the things that I want to see, and how can you make something that is compassionate and potentially can be healing to someone? Or, you know, they talk about in Buddhism, like there's Tonglen practice, which is like someone in, you know, breathing in like the suffering of either yourself or others, and then breathing out like a kind of hopefulness. And, you know, you can see art or fiction or whatever being a version of that, where you try to create something that's hopeful, but that also recognizes pain, you know? It doesn't run from the pain. It, like, it actually acknowledges it. Because I feel like so much of entertainment now is so much about distraction and, you know, like a bombarding of, you know, it's like it's all light and noise. And, you know, for me, after having that experience, a lot of that stuff feels very empty or something, or it just feels like it's, you know, adding to this sense of anxiety that you get in life, because there's just so much coming at you. And, you know, whether I've succeeded in that or not, I feel like there is an impulse there that I feel like, you know, even if Enlightened fails, I don't want to, you know, walk away from what I'm trying to, I guess, achieve, which is like try to make something that is, you know, a little bit more maybe contemplative or a little slowed down and a little bit more about like, how do we live, as opposed to just, you know, like something that's about distracting you from those questions.
Well, I think you just articulated why I like the series. Yeah.
Can I just say one thing is that when, you know, years ago I was on your show for The Amazing Race, and the head of HBO happened to be listening that night and told, you know, the people that worked with me, you know, it's like, you know, we should do a Mike White show. Something I said in that thing made him want to be in business with me. And I mean, out of that was born
really?
Enlightened.
Wow.
So it's very ironic. That
makes
like,
me so happy because I like the series so much.
Oh, awesome. Well, we're talking. It's just, it's funny how it full circle, like that you're the last person I'm going to be talking to before I go in there and have this final sort of like, you know, what is the future? But yeah, so thank you for Enlightened, Terry.
Oh, gosh. Wow. Oh, wow. You've made my day. Well, Mike White, it's really been great to talk with you again, and I wish you the best. Thank you so much, and thank you so much for Enlightened.
Thank you.
Mike White is the co-creator, writer, and co-star of the HBO series Enlightened, which ended its second season last night. One of the new movie technologies of the 50s was the widescreen process known as Cinerama. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz reviews two Cinerama films that have been released on DVD and Blu-ray. This is Fresh Air. In the early 1950s, the movie industry was trying to get people away from their television sets by offering them things TV wasn't capable of matching: wide panoramic images, stereophonic sound, and even three dimensions. One of the first of these technical marvels was called Cinerama. Lloyd Schwartz has a review of two Cinerama films that have just been released on DVD.
Today, to get the public to attend a picture show, it's not enough to advertise a famous star they know. If you want to get the crowds to come around, you gotta have glorious technicolor, breathtaking cinemascope, and stereophonic sound. If Zanuck's latest picture were the good old-fashioned kind, there'd be no one in front to look at Marilyn's behind. If you want to hear applauding hands resound, you gotta have glorious Technicolor, breathtaking CinemaScope, and stereophonic sound.
As early as silent film, directors attempted to create widescreen images. But in the 1950s, it became a commercial necessity to give the multitude of new TV watchers what they couldn't get on a small screen. So even before CinemaScope, VistaVision, Todd AO, and Panavision, there was Cinerama, a process in which three projectors threw three simultaneous images onto a gigantic curved screen. Cinerama offered what no TV or movie screen could provide before, peripheral vision, which could make you feel as if you were really in the midst of the action. In 1952, the first Cinerama experiment, This is Cinerama, was a sensation, and even though the ticket prices were higher, people flocked to specially designed movie theaters to ride a roller coaster, fly over Niagara Falls, or sway in a gondola through the canals of Venice. Two later Cinerama films, How the West Was Won and The Wonderful World of the Brothers Grimm, had actual stories, but mainly Cinerama stuck to travelogues, probably wisely. This is Cinerama and the 1958 Windjammer, which was filmed in a similar but slightly superior technique called Cinemiracle, have just been released on DVD and Blu-ray. Even watching them on a TV screen, in a format called Smilebox, which simulates the curved Cinerama screen, that roller coaster ride at New York's Rockaway Beach is still pretty breathtaking and fun. As a music critic, I'm of course especially interested in the musical selections and how well they work, or not. Part of the new Cinerama process was stereophonic sound, which in 1952 was not quite yet a household phenomenon. So audiences must have been startled to be surrounded by the sound of the Vienna Choir Boys, or Mormon Tabernacle Choir. The biggest musical numbers in This is Cinerama are two episodes from Verdi's Aida, filmed on the grand stage of La Scala, Milan's splendiferous opera house. It's great to be on La Scala's expansive stage looking out at the glittering audience. But the pseudo-Egyptian ballet and the klutzy staging of the triumphal march were already operatic clichés. And while the onstage trumpets are impressive in stereo, these opera sequences are hardly as exciting as flying over Niagara Falls. There are also musical passages in the film Windjammer, which is a mildly charming 1958 semi-documentary about young Norwegian trainees working on a magnificent square rigger sailing from Oslo across the Atlantic to the Caribbean, New York City, and up the eastern seaboard. The wide-angle technique works best on the open seas, unlike the tight kaleidoscopic views of Manhattan made for this film by the famed photojournalist Ouija. There's a Wind in Your Hair score by the American composer Morton Gould, visits to a couple of folk festivals, and Arthur Fiedler conducting the Boston Pops. But the most treasurable musical moment has nothing at all to do with wide screens or stereophonic sound. It's rare footage of the legendary cellist Pablo Casals in San Juan, Puerto Rico, at 80, playing his favorite Catalan folk song. Here, modesty and poignant understatement win the day.
For us, Mr. Casals plays his favorite Catalan ballad, Song of the Birds.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of The Phoenix. He reviewed the new DVD and Blu-ray release of the 1950s widescreen films This is Cinerama and Windjammer. You can see a Cinerama image of the New York skyline on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. We'll close with the title music from one of the Cinerama movies Lloyd mentioned, How the West Was Won. I want to thank Dave Davies for hosting Fresh Air while I was on vacation last week. I enjoyed listening. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham, who was our engineer today, along with Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Nell Beschenstein. Roberta Schurach directs the show. I'm Terry Griff.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business and Executive MBA program at Yeshiva University. And from the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting strategic communications and collaboration to address the world's pressing environmental problems. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, Sandra Day O'Connor, the first woman to serve on the Supreme Court. When she graduated from law school in 1952, she called at least 40 law firms.
And not one of them would give me an interview. I was a woman. And they said, we don't hire women.
Justice O'Connor has a new book called Out of Order. Join us.